Before we begin going through the text, are there any questions that you may have thought of during this morning's talk or in your discussion over lunch?
Yeah.
My question is about sleep and subtle mind. How is it that when I have an illness, for example, a cough, I'll be coughing the whole day? Even after taking cough medicine, I'll still be coughing. But when I fall asleep for 8 hours, miraculously the cough stops. But when I wake up the next morning, my gross mind comes back. The cough starts again. So my question is it because during sleep, the gross mind dissolves into the subtle mind, and somehow the gross body forgets that it's sick? So is it possible then, through the practice of meditation, to deepen it in such a way that we exist in our subtle mind throughout the day, so that would somehow alleviate karmic effects of mental afflictions or even physical illnesses like cough?
So did you get the question during sleep? It seems that the cough reflex is diminished or stopped. And why? And does it mean that if we can maintain dreamlike sleep, dreamlike state during the day, we might be able to suppress such thing? I think from the way it's taught, what happens when we go to sleep and when we die, that during this process of the mind becoming more subtle during sleep, indeed the activity of the sense organs diminishes, and like, you know, we have, when we're asleep, we have much less capacity to hear things, smell things, taste things, touch things. And I think the cough reflex belongs to the sense of touch. So it would be reasonable to say that it's true that even though we cough a lot during the day, we do less when we're asleep because the actual reflex is suppressed due to the physiological contraction of the mind from the sense organs. And indeed, it's true, often we have a cold or something, when we do wake up, there's a lot of phlegm has been built up in our chest. And the morning cough, especially in smokers, is well recognized. So probably that's what happens. Meditators, yes, it's true that as one gains more and more powerful single-pointed concentration, one necessarily withdraws the wind energy from the sense organs. So the mind of single-pointed concentration is mental consciousness. It's not one of the five sense consciousnesses. The activity of the senses is suppressed or diminished, or ceases as the winds withdraw from the sense organs through the power of concentration. So in meditation, it would be similar to sleep. You don't hear things, see things, smell things, and so on. Difficult to imagine bringing that level of awareness into the waking life, because the waking life implies that we are sensorily alert and looking, hearing, smelling, tasting. That is for us, say, ordinary beings or even practitioners, it's hard to see that one could combine such a withdrawal from the senses with being awake. I mean, ultimately, of course, a Buddha's mind is always at the clear light stage. And that's the mental consciousness. But mental consciousness also has the capacity to beware of visual objects, auditory objects, smell, taste, and touch objects. That is a capacity of our mental consciousness which we are unable to manifest. It occurs every time we are visually aware or auditory aware of some sound or some sight. That sensory awareness goes for a period of time, and then the mind, the mental consciousness, takes over thinking about the object. But there is a brief moment in between that transition from sensory awareness to the mental awareness, of mental direct awareness of the sense object. But it is so brief that we don't notice it. We immediately go into thinking mode. All right? Anything else? Yeah. So I'm going deaf with old age, but you've got a loud voice.
When in a dream you kill an ant, do you accumulate negative karma?
I see. No, because the objects of the dreams aren't real. They're real for the mind in the dream, but they're not actual cats or beings or others. So one does not create the karma of killing. One does, however, increase the the potential or the seed of aggression in the mind. But that is like a desire, attachment, aggression. This can be increased, but that's not a karmic result. All right. Oh, yeah, one more. Oh, yeah.
So when the actor was playing a bad person, did he therefore generate negative karma and got the result of
negative? So this is the story of the little old lady in England who saw the actor who played a nasty character in a TV soap. And she saw him, the actor, in the supermarket, and she projected upon him the actual character from the... So she hit him with her umbrella for being nasty. So did she create karma?
Did the actor create negative karma from acting?
Oh, did the actor create negative karma by acting? depends what was happening in his mind. that's an interesting question. Because in creating karma, the predominant factor is the attitude in the mind behind the act. So, I guess a really good actor who plays an aggressive person and abusing somebody, and they really identify with their character, they probably do shout with aggression towards the other actors. So there probably would be a degree of karma in that action. But it's diminished, of course. You know, we're going to come to that. It's the next major topic, is the actual branches of creating karma. So, again, the answer is, it's a bit vague, depends upon really what's going on in the mind of the actor. Yeah.
I was curious about your definition of mind, and you call it the continuum of
clarity and awareness. And you mentioned with awareness, like, to be aware, do you have to label something and make it a concept, or not?
Not necessarily. Awareness is it's just described technically as cognitive engagement. Like the object is appearing with clarity, and there's this quality of mind which knows the object. Now, it can include giving the name, the term, the conventional term to the object, but it doesn't have to include that. It is, well, knowing. What's an example for an animal? Maybe, you know, animals through experience will know what types of leaves are suitable to eat and what's not suitable to eat. And the animal will know from the appearance or the smell of the leaf, from past experience, it will know that this is in general something to be eaten, but whether it's suitable to be eaten is not. So it will know that. And so it will either eat or avoid eating the leaf through that knowledge. So that just comes to my mind as a illustration of awareness. It's cognitive understanding. Very unique to mind. You know, like our cameras could take most fantastic images, but computers can have so much information, but there's no knowledge. Knowledge is a defining characteristic of mind. So is there such a thing as artificial intelligence? I would say no. Because this quality of knowing, which we equate with intelligence, is mental. It's not physical. And all about computers is physical. I think I mentioned that His Holiness the Dalai Lama was asked once, will they ever make computers able to be conscious or have intelligence? And his answer was, well, maybe if they develop a computer which will be a suitable support for mind, then maybe the computer will be intelligent. But you can't create intelligence. That is a definitive quality of mind. All right, so as I warned you, I'm going to say something that the His Holiness the Dalai Lama has said about what we were discussing this morning, particularly the subtle, clear light mind and the relationship between the mind, its supporting wind energy, and our experience. So, this is taken from a text called the Gelugkagyu Mahamudra, a commentary by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, which I attended a long, long time ago, but I didn't really understand. The mind within the human or animal embryo, so he's talking about after conception and the beginning of embryonic formation, the mind becomes increasingly coarse as it is progressively supported by the increasingly coarse physical elements. So you know, in Buddhism we talk about the elements of matter, not referring to the elements as we know, from chemistry and physics, but the four elements of earth, fire, water and wind are qualities of matter. Earth element is the supportive quality of matter. Water element is the adhesive, moistening quality of matter. Fire element is the quality of heat and chemical activity, digestion and so on. And wind element is a quality of movement, flowing, lightness. So, it is a wind element, the subtle wind element, which supports the subtle mind emerging as a result of karma from the clear light state after conception. So as it becomes more coarse, corresponding, the mind becomes more coarse as a result of karma, then those four elements manifest, the wind, the movement, the water, fire, and earth. So he says that correspondingly, as these coarse physical qualities manifest with the development of the embryo, correspondingly, mind gives rise to the appearance of those elements in the forms of external sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and tangibles. So, the embryo develops, the sense organs, and then the fetus, and then we're born. And so, the sensory organs, which we see, smell, taste, touch, and hear things, the sense consciousness is in the mind, and it's coming from karma, as well as the appearance of the objects of the senses. There is a karmic causation in the external elements as well. So His Holiness says the specific appearance or forms of those appearances of external elements are shaped by karmic propensities from past actions that have been transmitted with the continuity of the clear light mind. So, as we said, during the previous life, this consciousness is very coarse, and the mental consciousness is bearing the karmic potencies, as well as the seeds of the various emotions, as well as memories, knowledge. And as we die, the sense consciousness is stopped, the mental consciousness becomes very, very, very fine to clear light, still bearing all of those potencies and seeds. And then, having died, and the clear light mind entering the womb of a future mother, becoming more coarse, those seeds and karmic potencies are still there. They're born on the clear light mind. They're carried on the clear light mind. So His Holiness says, thus, the clear light mind can be seen to be the source of all impure appearances. Right, the fundamental source of the external world, the objects of our senses. So all of the clarity, the aspect of the mind, clarity, taking the aspect of the object, and as well as the appearances of the objects of our mind, all phenomena are the emanation or the play of the clear light mind of deep awareness. So you see, when we say these are the emanation or the play, the sport of the clear light mind, because of the karmic potencies being born in the clear light mind, because of the karma to be born, whatever form we're born as, then there is the arisal of both the subjective awareness and the object. There is a karmic relationship with our world that we experience. So we were born with human karma, so the world which we experience is coloured, is shaped by our mind, and the way we apprehend this world is from a human point of view. As animals, there is an external world. But the way in which it appears is dependent upon the karma of each individual. So collectively, we and the animals are responsible, karmically responsible, for our world in general. But if we look specifically, even different humans, we experience phenomena in personal ways. That's our karma. And animals, in maybe a different way, and that's animal karma. Hungry ghosts, in another way. So His Holiness continues, on another level, karmic potencies ripen not only into experiences, subjective experiences of happiness or suffering, but also into the external conditions that are the circumstances for those experiences. The internal, progressive re-emergence of the elements from the primordial, clear light mind is not only parallel to the external process of emergence from empty space, but in some intimate way is causally related to it. So His Holiness, it was the second week, or I can't remember, the first weekend, we talked about the evolution of the universe. There are four phases. And in any particular world system, the phases of emptiness, when there is only like the most minute particles, which in Buddhism are called space particles, which actually quantum physicists agree that space is particulate and that tiny, tiny particles. Then, at that time, the sentient beings in that region of the universe are all in ethereal divine realm lives as a form and formless realm. Incredibly long time. Their karma for that rebirth begins to end, and correspondingly a wind blows. Wind element begins to be activated, stirring the space particles, which begin to come together. There is heat, there is water, they coagulate, and there is earth as they aggregate into planets, stars, solar systems as we recognize. So that's what His Holiness is referring to. From empty space, the universe, not totally empty space particles, but there evolves. So this is called the period of formation, which is equally a long time. And then there's a period of abiding, where the sentient beings, whose karma, whose collective karma, had begun the origin of this corner of the universe, they're reborn progressively in lower levels of rebirth as the environments are suitable for a particular type of rebirth arise. So there's hell, hungry ghost, animal, human, divine, pure levels develop. So for a period of abiding, they're all functioning, and then the period of decline is again due to the collective karma of the beings in that corner of the universe changing. They're no longer dying with the karma to reborn in the hells, hungry ghosts, so those levels cease. And there is a corresponding eventual destruction of the human environment, animal environment, the desire realm, God's environments, and once again, the sentient beings are all reborn up in those ethereal form and formless realms, for another period of emptiness begins, and so on. Okay. So, His Holiness is just saying, there is a causal relationship between the ripening of the collective karmic imprints or potencies in the minds of all of us, which acts as a causal factor in our environment. He gives an example. One type of weather causes happiness or suffering in different people according to their karmic propensities. The immediate cause of the weather is the movement of the outer elements, local physical factors. So this is not karma. This is the movement of winds and tides, and clouds and so on. The chemical activity is a cause and effect process which is natural, external. It's not karma. But tracing the causes for these movements back, we come to the causal relationship between the emergence of the internal and external elements in the sentient beings. So, you see, His Holiness, he talks of these two processes of cause and effect happening. Karmic, like the beginning of the wind element in the period of formation, and coursing and coursing formation of stars and planets. Originally, there is a collective karmic causality. But that is not the only cause and effect process in the universe. There is the natural physical and chemical activity of the material world. And that is not karma. So there's an interplay between the collective causality of karma ripening in us sentient beings who experience the outer environment and the outer environment itself. Karmic actions or intentions always involve mind. The activity, chemical activity, doesn't involve mind. When the impulse of a karmic action ceases, the intention of doing an action of physical, verbal or mental action ceases, it builds up a habit, an instinct or a potential that can be said to be born on the mind stream of the person or the person who created that action. The problem is, how does such an instinct or such a potential on a mind stream, specifically the mind of clear light, because that's what our life began with, how does that bring about any immediate change in the external world? He says, such as his example, the current cold spell in Dharamsala. Since the teachings are not clear about this point, we need to analyze it ourselves. So we're not going to find, this is it, this is the nitty-gritty thing. How does ripening of karma in the minds of sentient beings act of causality of forming the outside world? It is said that it happens, but not how it happens. We have to think about it ourselves. He says, I think there is definitely some kind of relation between internal and external elements. On one level, we can say that now our internal elements are totally under the influence of the external elements. Right? So, really, for us now, we are very much influenced by the external world, whether it's hot or cold, whatever happening is influencing us. But when we reach an advanced state of meditation or realization, we can gain control over our internal elements. That's the big point, to gain control over the mind and its supporting subtle wind. Then, through the power of meditation, our internal elements can affect the external ones, such as by starting or stopping rain. I've seen this many times. My own teacher, Lama Trungpa Nyeshe, back in 1979, one of his students was getting married. It was a retreat. And so it was the end of the retreat. And it was in the mountains to the east of Melbourne in Australia. And it was a terribly cold day. It was even beginning to snow and rain, drizzle and sleet. It was horrible. And so the wedding ceremony was about to happen. And Lama Yeshe said, I'll deal with this. And so he did some meditation. At one stage he told me to go out and light a fire and he gave me some salt to burn the salt. I had no idea what I was doing, but I did it. And then when Lama finished his preparation and the wedding happened, the people went outside. the sky, which was totally overcast and grey and drizzling, there was a circle appeared of blue sky, like a big circle and sunshine. And the newly wedded couple happily went off to the hotel to get drunk. And we finished the meditation course. Similarly, I'd only been a monk for 1 year, and I was attending a Kalachakra initiation by His Holiness the Dalai Lama in Ladakh, in the Himalayas, northern India. Actually on the banks of the Indus River, way up in the mountains. Huge valley. And there was one, he wasn't a monk, he was a practitioner from Dharamsala. His name was Yeshe Dorji. He was married, etc. And he used to have his hair tied up in a knot with a vajra, like a Dorji. He's quite a character, with big glasses. And His Holiness, like we're all, there were maybe 100,000 people in the open. And His Holiness was in this pavilion giving the Kalachakra. And you could see these storm clouds coming along the valley, and like this purple rain coming. And I was sort of on the periphery, sitting amongst the monks. And Yeshe Dorji was, he had a little tin whistle, blowing his whistle and saying mantras and where. And I watched. I couldn't believe it. This purple rain cloud was coming directly towards us. And Yeshe Dorji started doing his act, whatever it was. And the rain cloud turned 90 degrees, crossed the river, went up the other side of the valley, and then went down the valley. So, anyway, controlling rain can be done through the power of concentration. The internal elements can control the external elements through the power of concentration. So, His Holiness says, because this relationship is observable on the level of the spiritual path, of actions involving the internal elements affecting changes in the external ones, he said, I believe there must also be some similar relationship on the basis level as well. So you know, when we talk about the Buddhist path, the basis is the ordinary being, right? A being like ourselves, the ordinary body and mind under the control of karma and disturbing emotions. Then there's the path level. Path refers to gaining the mental realizations, many graded realizations, and there's the resultant level, Buddhahood. So there's the basis, the path level, and the resultant level. So His Holiness is saying that we can observe internal control, controlling the outer elements on the path level, therefore probably it can happen on the basis level as well. He doesn't know how. He admits, I don't know how. But it's likely. All right. So he says, we could say that change in the external elements, such as variation in the weather, is the work of God. But if we conceive of God as a supreme, omnipotent creator, an individual whose actions arise without being affected by anything, we would have to conclude, on the basis of logic, that this is an impossible mode of existence. Actions can only arise dependently, affected by causes and conditions. Buddhism asserts that the cause for external changes is karma, and since the impulses of karma arise from the mind, and ultimately from the primordial clear light mind, and set back into that mind, we can say that the deepest cause of the external conditions is mind. Alright, there's more. from that quotation, but I think the main point that I wanted to get across is that there is more to the world than we give, than we understand. That there is a relationship between our environment and our mind, a causal relationship. It's not totally subjective. We are not totally under the control of external conditions. There is an interdependent relationship, and that is karma. Oh, no, that is the result of karma. Karma literally means action. And so the word karma specifically refers to mental intention or will or purpose behind our acts. That's specifically. But we can talk about karmic cause and effect, because intended actions create potencies on the mind which bring about future results. Okay. So, in the Graduated Path to Enlightenment, the Lumrim, the first outline in the section on karma is developing the faith of conviction and trust in the laws of cause and effect. You see, in engaging in spiritual activity, we've got to be convinced that we should do it. That there is something important to be done in our life. And the important thing is to wake up to the reality of karma. But karma is very subtle. And it's said that only the omniscient mind of a Buddha knows the intricate details of karma. So for us to engage in a spiritual path, there must be a level of faith. So faith, you remember, we were talking, is defined as belief in something that is correct. We don't yet know it, but we believe that it is correct. And it's got to be correct. Faith, belief in something which is incorrect is not faith. Because the definition of faith is that the object has to be valid. We don't yet know it, but knowledge of the true validity of karmic cause and effect depends upon faith. Knowledge of anything depends upon faith. We go to school to learn a particular topic. We get the information, and that's held on faith. We don't really know the underlying meaning of the information the school teachers, our university professors teach us. We have to take it home and work on it and get to know it. But if we didn't have faith, we wouldn't go to school. Maybe kids could use that as an argument against their parents. I don't know. I don't believe in school, so I don't have to go. So, strong trust in the relationship between cause and effect is the basis for living in virtue, like to establish a code of ethical conduct. If we don't have faith in establishing a code of conduct in society, conduct which avoids harmful actions and cultivates positive actions, we're not going to do it. If we don't have faith in the teaching that to kill, we don't usually kill humans, but we certainly kill animals because they're pests, or because we want to eat them, or just for sport, then if we totally believe that there is no fault in killing animals. We might refrain from killing humans, but we see no fault. In fact, the Bible says God created the animals for humans to eat. So, we won't hesitate in killing animals. So, the teaching on karma includes not only humans but animals. To kill an animal is negative karma and brings about very heavy results. So we don't know that. So to establish the ethical code of not killing any sentient being, it begins with faith that what the Buddha taught was true. Dharma practice requires mental and physical effort. And without confidence in karmic causality, we cannot change our attitude and our behavior. No, we will steal, we will lie, we will harshly abuse others because they deserve it. Or I can get away with it. It's difficult to oppose our upbringing in a society based upon, you know, looking after number one. Thus, trust in karma is the root of all temporary and ultimate happiness, because abiding by a code of ethical behavior of not killing, not stealing, not lying, not harming others in any way, you know, deliberately, and doing the opposite, saving lives, protecting, feeding, looking out, etc., that is the meaning of establishing a code of ethical conduct. So this needs to be established in our mind through faith. Faith or trust in a virtuous object is faith. Trust in a non-virtuous object is not faith. There are two levels of faith. Ordinary faith is based on faith in the three jewels in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, but is not based upon a valid intelligence, valid cognition. Knowledge-based faith, so there's ordinary faith and then there's knowledge-based faith, is based upon valid cognition of the source of suffering and how to overcome it by relying on the three jewels. So you see, initially we have standard or ordinary faith, but then by investigating the underlying teachings on cause and effect and really and meditating and gaining the intellectual, the knowledge of karmic cause and effect, then we really understand the source of suffering, karma, and how to overcome it by practicing Dharma. Now, I mean, certainly this is my experience in going from totally materialistic, scientific worldview to accepting Buddhism to the point of deciding to take refuge. Karma and rebirth did not fit my understanding. And I spent a long time checking up, thinking, comparing, and finally coming to the conclusion that it's right. But that was just basic faith. But it was a long time ago. And in all the years since, the knowledge has increased more and more. I don't have direct meditative awareness, but I think I mentioned in another talk that in 2005, after about 30 years as a monk, I went into a three-year retreat where I built a cabin in the bush in Australia, didn't see anybody for 3 years, and supposed to meditate on, you know, concentration, calm and body, which I didn't get. But at the end of the 3 years, when I came out, and people said, oh, how'd you go? What happened? I said, my refuge increased. So, although I didn't get what I'd wanted, calm abiding, but my confidence, I had, through 3 years of total focus on the mind, on the teachings, I can't tell you exactly what it was, but my inner conviction in the validity of karmic cause and effect grew stronger, and therefore the refuge in Buddha Dhamma Sangha grew stronger. And that, to me, was a fantastic result of the retreat. I was very happy. So now I've got to go back again for another 3 years and try and get concentration. But it was okay. You know, we've been in samsara since beginningless time. It's going to take a while to get out of it. Okay, so now, in the notes, the first page, there's four aspects of karma. The four general aspects of karma is certain. Karma shows great increase. One cannot experience a result if one has not created the karma for it to happen. And once created, karmic seeds do not lose their potency. So this is reflecting on karma. The first point, karma is certain, which means that virtuous actions always result in happiness, and non-virtuous actions always result in unhappiness. Actually, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, he said, why? And he said, oh, I can't tell you why, because that's the way it is. Virtue results in happiness, non-virtue in unhappiness. So we can check up. We can see it happening. We can see our mind. We can be mindful of what's happening to us, what's going on in our mind, in our everyday actions, and we can be honest, say, yep, my mind was non-virtuous, and that was associated with this awful bad experience. And the occasions, the short occasions, where really nice, good experiences happen, our mind is virtuous. There is a relationship between attitude and experience. So that we can check up to see whether it's true or not. As it's taught in the Lam Rim, all happiness, from a cool breeze in the hell to the bliss of an arhat, arises from previous virtue. Happiness and misery do not arise without cause or from causes discordant with the result. So in any cause and effect process, there is accordance, there is something in common between the cause and the result. You can't have a result that has nothing, no relationship with the cause. Yeah, there is a result. So happiness is a result, and happiness comes from a concordant cause, a virtuous mind. Virtue is a pleasant mind, a benevolent mind, which does a pleasing action towards others. That is the concordant relationship between virtue and happiness. Non-virtue, the concordant relationship is negativity, disturbing the from the a negative karma or non-virtuous karma is created through anger, attachment, desire, pride, jealousy, an agitated mind which deliberately inflicts pain on others. The result, the karmic result, or the immediate result, the other is unhappy. Rebounding upon ourselves, the distant result, is unhappiness. That is the relationship. That is the certainty of karma. So when we think about that, then we should generate the resolution. I must pursue virtue, train my mind in virtue, and abandon non-virtue. So this is the beginning of the decision to abide in a code of ethical conduct, to practice Dharma. The story in the Lum Rim that is often given to illustrate this point is when the king came to there's a group of Buddha students and the Buddha himself in the mango grove, and the king had heard that this sort of Angulimala, the guy who killed so many people, and Buddha subdued him and he became a disciple of Buddha. So the king of the region heard that this mass murderer was amongst Buddha's followers, and he came very angrily with his troops and rode into the grove on their horses with the intention of catching this man. And so as they entered, they heard this incredibly beautiful chanting of a monk somewhere was, reciting the sutras, but his voice was so beautiful that the horses became calm and the king dismounted. And he totally forgot about Angulimala. He said, "Bring me the monk who has such a beautiful voice." I think Buddha said something like, "Well, he's better heard than seen." The king, no, bring him. So they brought this monk who had an incredibly ugly body, malformed, quite difficult to look at. So the king said, "What's going on? How can a person with such an unattractive appearance has such an exquisitely beautiful voice?" And so the Buddha explained that in a previous life, a large stupa was being built, and there was one of the workers who was building it kept complaining all the time about it was too big, too difficult to build it, so he wasn't too happy about building the stupa. But at the end, the stupa was so impressive that he made an offering of golden bells to the stupa. And so this, the shortness, the ugliness of the monk's body was the karmic result of complaining and having negative attitude towards building the stupa, and the exquisitely beautiful voice was the karmic result of offering the bells to the stupa. So that's the story that you hear in the Lum Rim to illustrate that point. The second general point about karma is that karmic potentials on the mind show great increase. So unless a virtuous potential is obstructed or damaged by anger, or non-virtuous potentials are obstructed or overcome by the opponent powers, karmic potentials increase in potency over time. And this is a scary one. Having established a karmic potential in our mind, virtuous or non-virtuous, it has a tendency over time, before it brings its fruit, it has this increase in strength in proportion to the duration of time. The example that is often given of the small actions bringing big results is that Buddha was once on an alms round, went to a house, and a lady opened the door, and so she gave a small cake, sesame cake of some type, to the Buddha. And so, as was the custom, the Buddha predicted that as a result of giving this sesame cake then she would achieve enlightenment so many thousands of lifetimes down the line. And the husband, who was hearing all this, criticized the Buddha and said, "Ah, how can you monks do this? You're telling lies just to get food. You make this lie of great results from small offerings." The Buddha said that just as a tiny seed, like of the banyan tree, tiny seed can grow eventually into a spreading banyan tree that can cover 500 ox carts, etc., then karmic potentials have this tendency to increase in strength. Now, virtuous, if we get angry, particularly towards the Bodhisattva, our collection of virtue will stop increasing. And if we generate really strong, like wrong views, negative views, we can actually harm the potentials so they can't even ripen. So this tendency to grow stronger can be stopped by later conditions. Negative potentials can be stopped and even destroyed by applying the four opponent powers, which we'll talk about later. So already there is some indication that we can work with our karma, not only avoid creating negative karma in the future and determine to create positive karma in the future, we can actually do something about the past. We can eliminate our past negative karma, and we can enhance past positive karma by rejoicing, the simple action of rejoicing, thinking how good things are, and that increases the strength. And Lama Rinpoche, he gave the scary example once of killing a mosquito with anger is relatively small compared to the negative karma of killing a human with anger. And the reason is that you cause so much more harm to the human. To be human, that person has created so much virtue and has so much potential as a human, not just potential for enjoyment, but for spiritual development. Whereas the mosquito has a short life of only a few days, and it has no potential, has the potential, but doesn't have the capacity to understand Dharma or practice Dharma. So the harm caused to the being who is a mosquito by killing it is much less than the harm caused by causing a human. So the karmic result of killing a human is much, much heavier. However, if we kill a mosquito with anger, with full action, we're pleased that we killed it, I think something very scary, like if we don't purify that act, I think Lama Soba said within a week, that karma of killing a mosquito has grown to the power of killing a human. So, that's scary. Anyway, it's to be thought about. We can purify it. The third general point about karma: we cannot experience a result if we have not created the karma for it to happen. So, no mental experience happens by chance. One cannot experience the results of karma created by another, and we can't transfer our karma onto another. There, again, the story in the Lum Rim to illustrate that point is that there was a group of nobles who set fire to a hut in the forest. They didn't know that inside the hut was a meditator who had achieved the state of Arhat. Their maidservant objected to burning the hut, but the nobles just did it out of fun. So later, eventually, many times, lifetimes later, those nuns became, those nobles became nuns who achieved the state of Arhat, liberation. Their maidservant was reborn as their cook. And so the house they were living in caught fire, and through their psychic power, the Arhats, the nuns, were able to rise up out of the fire. But when they did so, they reflected upon the cause, and as the cause of having killed the Arhat in previous lives became aware of it, they lost the power to fire, fell back into the flames and were consumed. The maidservant, who had objected to burning the hut down, had been reborn as their cook, and who was not able to fly, but was able to escape out the kitchen door and not be burnt up. So, in terms of the resolution, from the previous point, karma shows great increase. The resolution is, I must pursue even smallest virtue and abandon even the smallest non-virtue. And then in this case, the resolution is, I must practice the opponent powers. I must overcome my accumulation of negative karma. The final general point is that once created, karmic seeds or karmic potencies do not lose their power. So not only do they increase, but they won't from their own side decrease. We can decrease the power through other actions, but from their side they won't lose their potency, even being carried for many, many, many lifetimes. So the resolution we should generate when we think about that is to invoke sincere wish or prayer to always abide in virtue and to dedicate our virtue with bodhicitta. Whenever we do a small virtuous action, like I gave the example before, like giving food to a hungry animal, we create a virtuous imprint. But that virtuous imprint can be destroyed by anger, later anger, or wrong views. But even doing something small, feeding one animal, relieving the hunger of one animal, if in our mind we generate the strong wish, just as I've relieved this animal of hunger, my relieve the hunger and thirst of all universal sentient beings. Sincerely, generate that thought. Not only the hunger for food, but the hunger for enlightenment. Right? That makes that virtue completely unable to ever be lost. Whereas otherwise we would have burnt it by just getting angry. Not only does it make it unable to be lost, it's so powerful. It is is said to be multiplied by the number of beings that we incorporate in our mind, just in our thought. May all beings be happy, free from hunger. So the words, the mouth can say the words, but that's not enough. The action of the mind has to have that sincere thought and delight to relieve the hunger of all sentient beings. That's possible. That is that genuine attitude can be manifested. We have to train ourselves to do it. We don't do it too often. We rarely do it for even our family, even ourselves. But this shows by being more aware of the reality of existence, the reality of karma, the reality of the power of mind, and utilize the power of our mind in our Dharma practice, practicing bodhicitta, actualizing universal responsibility and universal compassion. The smallest action creates unimaginable virtue. And if the thought is that through, if the thought is included, through this action, may I become a Buddha and have the actual capacity to relieve the suffering and hunger of all sentient beings, then that virtue doesn't become a cause for samsara, not for a happy rebirth. It becomes a cause for enlightenment, for Buddhahood. So again, this goes back to the original point. From the clear light mind, which bears these karmic potencies, arises samsara and nirvana, or Buddhahood. So, karma specifically refers to actions created by an ignorant mental continuum. But actions created in a spiritual sense, in the virtual sense, through bodhicitta, even though the mind may still have some ignorance, the state of mind at the time of the action becomes a cause, the result, Buddhahood. So those are just the four general properties of karma, which, when we really think about them, should, well, as Lama Zopa said once, if you really understand these points, you won't be able to sleep at night. And Lama Zopa doesn't sleep at night. So. Well, he didn't, used to. Getting old like me. Sometimes you need a bit of... But as so many of us have observed in relationship with Lama Zopa Rinpoche, he might look like he's asleep, but if you go into his room and clean the altar or do something, if you make a mistake, he's right onto you. Right onto you. So what appears to our mind sleeping is not necessarily correct. Okay. So now the outline, specifically thinking about the paths of negative karma or black karma, the 10 naturally negative non-virtues. So these 10 non-virtuous actions, killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying and so on, body, speech and mind, they're negative whether you believe in karma or not. There are other actions, you know, like, you know, if we take vows, we take the Mahayana precepts, you know, to not eat after midday, and so on, then normally eating after midday is not negative karma. But if we take the precepts in the morning to not eat after midday, and then we disregard it and go ahead and eat, that becomes negative karma. So it's not naturally a negative karma, but it's negative according to the circumstances that we break our vow. We also take the vow not to kill, steal, lie, and so on. So, to kill at any time of the day is naturally negative. It's also doubly negative because we break a vow. So it's extremely negative to break a vow. It's extremely positive to keep a vow. So, these are naturally negative. And the first is taking the life of any sentient being. So this is either through one's own action or by instructing another to kill for us. The object of the karma of taking the life or killing as any sentient being other than oneself. And that includes a fetus that is clearly recognized, you know, a woman is pregnant, and you engage in inducing, getting someone else to induce a termination of the pregnancy because you don't want that fetus to survive. Life begins at conception, not at birth. So that's the object. So there are the four branches to make a karmic action complete. The object is the first branch. The second is the motivation. So the motivation has three aspects. There's unmistaken recognition of the object. So, for example, there's some person who we hate and we intend to kill them, but in the dark we mistakenly kill someone else, then this branch is not complete. We did not intend really to kill the one who unfortunately got in the way. It's still heavy negative karma, but it's not the specific karma of murder or killing. Just in our legal system, we have different levels. We have first degree murder, second degree, we have manslaughter, and there is a different culpability associated with taking the lives of others. So, in that's an example, if that part of the motivation branch is not complete. Secondly, there has to be the full intention to kill. So we might strike somebody with intention to hurt them, but we only wanted to hurt them, we didn't want to kill them, but as a result of our action, they die. So our intention wasn't to kill, and so this branch is not complete. Again, still a negative karma, but it's not the full karma of killing. The third part of the motivation is all important. One of the three poisons, ignorance, anger, or attachment, they're the three root poisons, has to be involved in the action. So clearly, we kill animals through desire, or for wealth, or for sport. Through hatred, we kill to eliminate the object of our dislike. And through ignorance, we can kill not through hatred or desire, but, for example, culturally, we make sacrifices, or we execute people, or we kill pests, mosquitoes, rats, snakes, by considering them fair game. They're vermin and they are to be destroyed. So that is ignorance. That's killing through ignorance. So when that part of the motivation is there, the branch is there, is complete. To actually kill, they call it the consummating action of killing is aggression. You cannot take the life of a sentient being without, at the moment, an impulse of aggression to cut the life force of a sentient being. I think, as an example, when I was a boy, I used to keep pigeons, and one of my pigeons, one of my favourite ones, was attacked by a hawk. And I can't remember, but I found it on the ground outside the loft, and its whole chest was ripped open, and it was clearly dying, still alive, but there was no chance, it was really badly mutilated. So I thought to put it out of its misery. So I didn't quite know how, I was only very young, I didn't quite know how to do this. So I sort of put it on a chopping block. We used to have wood fires, so I had the axe. I was looking at this I could not. I just could not cut us out. So I didn't know what to do. As I could see it, I just could not kill it. So I thought, all right. So to not see it, I got a bit of rope and tied one end to a post and put a loop around the pigeon's neck. And then I put a box, a cardboard box, over the pigeon so I couldn't see it. And then I sort of yanked on the rope to choke it to death. But horrifyingly, with the rope becoming taut, the box flew away, and there's my poor pigeon there, strangling to death. Quite traumatic for a young boy's mind. But, you know, when I reflect back, as long as I could see it, I could not generate an aggressive impulse to kill it. And it says, you can only take the life of another at the moment of doing it. Even though there might be desire or ignorance to actually kill, there's a bit of anger there, aggression. So the action branch, the third branch, is to kill by force, by poison, by magic, by mantras, and so on. So often the question comes up, well, what about euthanasia? If somebody is very sick, in pain, they're dying, can't we kill them? So, in such a situation, the object action is there, the object branch is there, the action branch will be there, and the completion branch, which is the final branch, I will kill. But we have to check up the motivation branch, right? So, there definitely is a degree of compassion, most likely, degree of compassion. But that compassion can be associated with some ignorance. We believe that to take the life of this dying person now will protect them, will stop them suffering. It's the right thing to do. So we do it. It's not necessarily, it could be the right thing. But only a clairvoyant mind, knowing or aware of the full karmic scenario, can accurately know whether it's to be done or not. The person is experiencing the ripening of negative karma, and this can bring an end to it. But if we, out of compassion, try to stop the suffering, the karma's not finished, and they've got to experience it in the future. And they may be reborn in a much lower a hell realm or something to experience that karma. We don't know. So unless we have the clairvoyance to fully be aware of the karmic situation, there's danger of ignorance coming into the equation and negativity. So what to do? As long as we're human, you know, we have great potential, even in great pain and great dying, and we're dying. So, every moment of life as a human is an opportunity to train our mind in virtue. So hopefully, when we're in that situation, the dying person, you can't teach them Dharma in the beginning. But we can remind somebody, we can make everything as comfortable and as loving and as friendly as possible. Give them what they need to ease their pain. Try to keep their mind alert. Don't just give them tranquilizers which will knock them out. But try to reach a balance of relative pain-free and surround them with love and kindness. Even recite mantras on their behalf. And yes, they're dying, and they will die, but their attitude can be greatly enhanced, and the karma will burn out. So, it's difficult. What about turning off the life support? Well, you know, lamas have said that to answer that question, a person on life support is dying naturally. And if we, it's only the art of life support which is sort of keeping them going. So switching off the life support is not the karma of killing, because they die naturally. They die as a result of karma. So when all the different situation is understood, and got the medical opinion, which is not necessarily valid, but it's the best we can rely on. There are situations where it's perfectly valid to turn off the life support, and you're not creating a karma of killing. Another thing comes, well, what about eating meat? Somebody has killed that animal which you bought the meat at the butcher's shop, and now you're eating it. Are you not committing the karma of killing? If we order somebody to kill an animal for us, yes, and we eat the flesh, we share the karma of killing with that person. Even if we don't order, like, say we're invited for a meal, and our host says, oh, welcome, we killed a duck just for you. So, having received that information, if we go ahead and eat the duck, we share the karma of killing. So we might have to tell a white lie. Oh, my doctor said I can't eat duck. it's bad for my body. Or something, then we don't get the karma of killing. In terms of the butcher shop, we weren't directly involved in the karma of the animal dying. You know, it was killed at the abattoir or somewhere, and we did eat the meat. So, as we weren't directly involved, we don't create the karma of killing. However, there is some negativity shared. If we eat that meat without any concern for the animal, but just pure desire for the taste of the meat, oh, this is so well cooked, oh, the sauce, magnificent, you know, eat it, disregarding the animal that lost its life for you to have that pleasure, then there's negative karma. Not of killing, but it's negative. If on the other hand, meat, in the Tibetan medical system, meat, every different type of meat has a medicinal quality. And there are certain, all foods have medicinal qualities. And there are some illnesses which respond to eating different types of food or meat. I think in the Tibetan medical system, even, lion meat, tiger meat, human meat is even a medicine. I don't know how you get hold of it, but so in that context, if you take the meat as medicine and you consider the animal that died in producing that medicine, and you generate compassion, say mattress for the animal, then you probably wouldn't be creating negative karma. Okay, so that's the action branch. The completion branch is the fourth branch. So there's the object, the motivation, the action, and then the completion is that the victim dies as a result of our action. And we are aware of it, and we are satisfied that we have achieved what we wanted. If immediately you generate regret at having killed the mosquito or the human, whatever, then this branch is not complete. There's, immediately there's regret and remorse. Oh, I wish I hadn't done that. Also, for this branch to be complete, the victim has to die before us. So, like, if we engage in combat with somebody and we mortally wound each other, then we die first, and then the other person dies after we've died, then we don't get this branch because our mind has left this body. Our mind is in the bardo or in another life. So it doesn't receive the branch of completion. So the full karma of killing is not committed in that situation. The negative karma of mortal wounding is accumulated. It's still very heavy negative karma. But the full branch is not of killing is not there. For the same reason, suicide is not the karma of killing, because one is dead and gone before this fourth branch, the completion branch, is created. There are different ways of committing suicide, different motivations for committing suicide, whether it's virtuous or non-virtuous is dependent mainly upon our state of mind when we do the act. One can give one's life, like the Buddha as a bodhisattva gave his life for the starving tigress and her cubs. So out of pure compassion and kindness, that was a virtuous act. It wasn't non-virtue. The occurrence in various realms of rebirth, the karma of killing doesn't occur in the hells. Death in the hells only occurs as a result of the expiry of karma. In fact, there's no such thing as a... A communal hell where many beings are born in the same place. Each being experiencing rebirth as a hell is in his or her personal hell. The other beings are hallucinations. They're more than hallucinations. The demons, the animal heads, and persecuting and cutting up with knives and everything, are all created by the power of the mind. It's not a place waiting for us to go. It's something which our mind entirely creates. And so we experience the suffering created by mind. And I say it's more than hallucination. An hallucination is something which appears to exist but doesn't exist at all. It's just this false appearance of the mind. But a hell experience, the flaming knives which the hallucinated demons cut you with, they function. It hurts. You experience, it's more than hallucination, but it's still totally created by the mind. So, the karma of killing doesn't occur in the hells. You live as long as your mind will project it, and then you die when that karma is expired. The northern continent, I don't know, many of you have probably heard the description of the world and the various continents. There are humans of different stages of evolution or stages in the world, and they're classified as northern continent, southern continent, western and eastern continent. Our human type is the southern continent type, where we have a variable lifespan and, we experience what we experience. But in other types of human, there's definite lifespans and different attitudes. The northern continent, I often call it the hippie paradise. People share everything, there's no possessiveness, and they sit around all day singing songs and having a nice time. So humans of the northern continent never commit the karma of killing because they're gentle, and they lack any sense of possessiveness of mind. They have no covetousness. They have no malice, no wrong views. But the karma of killing can occur at any other realm of the of rebirth, in the desire realm. Sorry, the form and formless gods do not kill. All right, the different types of results. I will go into those in detail tomorrow morning. So that concludes our discussion for today. Unless you have any outstanding questions, we can talk about tomorrow morning, but anything now? So thank you for your attention, and I hope it hasn't been too much or too little, too boring. We will go into the remaining outline that is printed tomorrow morning. So thank you. So to complete the karma of engaging in the discussion of the Dharma today, dedicate our collective positive energy to all other beings. I think that through this action, I quickly achieve my full potential of enlightenment, so that I may be able to be perfectly qualified to guide all mother sentient beings out of suffering.